Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
President Bush began the week by saying he hoped to substantially cut U.S. troops in Iraq this year. But today, military officials said that because of the recent violence in Iraq, 700 more Kuwait-based U.S. troops will be sent to Iraq for the next few weeks during a religious holiday. And the bodies of at least 87 men have been found across Baghdad in the past 2 days, all killed execution style, in sectarian violence that seems to have been sparked by an unusually deadly bombing in a Baghdad market on Sunday and the bombing of a Shiite mosque last month. Meanwhile, in his war crimes trial today, Saddam Hussein urged Iraqis to stop the violence and instead fight American troops. And before reporters were kicked out of the courtroom, he called the tribunal a comedy.
Comedy should never be done with Saddam Hussein and his comrades, only because he and his brothers with him were entrusted by the will of God to be leader of the people of Iraq.
Well, joining us for an Iraqi overview, Washington Post Baghdad Bureau Chief Ellen Nickmeyer, just back from the courtroom. Ellen, what was the tone of the trial today?
Saddam was in the courtroom, but he wasn't speaking to the judge. He was speaking to his public. He was speaking to the Iraqi people. It was from start to finish. He was aiming things for the TV cameras, and he was telling Iraqis that he knew how they were suffering. He talked about the bombing of the Samarra Mosque a couple of weeks ago that set off so much violence, and he called on them to resist. I mean, the judge kept trying to turn Saddam's microphone on and off just to make him answer the questions about the trial, but the court case itself was not what Saddam was concerned about today.
Well, it may be too early to tell, but do the things that Saddam Hussein is saying, are they resonating with Iraqis? Were they watching?
His trials have been very closely watched by the Sunni and Shia, and depending on who's listening, they can have a strong effect.
Well, Ellen, prior to today's trial, you wrote about yesterday's grisly discovery of over 80 bodies spread across the city of Baghdad and outside Baghdad, lying by the side of the road, sitting in vans. What is the thinking about these bodies, which seem to be the victims of execution rather than suicide bombings?
The thought is this is sectarian violence in a way that's different from bombings. And lots of times the suspicion falls on some of the Shiite religious militias or some of the forces within the Shiite-controlled interior ministry, although the Shia religious parties and the Shiite militias deny any responsibility.
And what you also wrote about the morgue and how there's a suspicion that Iraqi officials aren't really giving up-to-date information on the number of people killed, that the number that were discovered may only be the tip of the iceberg.
I've just realized in the past few months, mainly from morgue figures, that the death toll month to month here is a couple hundred in civilians, more than we really realize, and lots of those are execution-style killings. And international officials say in just the past few months, the government officials have been maybe trying to suppress information from the morgue about the numbers of dead, although the morgue and the government denies that. Hmm.
Ellen, we're coming up on the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. Do you feel that in Baghdad?
I don't know. I guess right now problems, the sectarian violence is kind of taking on a lot of steam, and I think that's on people's minds right now, not so much the third anniversary. I think people are more keyed to there being a couple of Shiite religious holidays coming up, which always gets hundreds of thousands of Shias together in one spot, and that can be a target for insurgents.
Well, speaking of that, military officials in the U.S. are saying that 700 more U.S. troops, Kuwait-based U.S. troops, are going to be deployed to Iraq for the next few weeks because of the religious holiday. Thoughts on that?
Iraqis would, a lot of them in the more troubled district would welcome the sight of more American troops. Iraqis I've talked to didn't see the Iraqi security forces as stepping up to stem this violence. And I never saw Iraqi security forces do anything to stop the militias or anything like that. So for people who are still vulnerable from this latest violence, and American troops are kind of a welcome sign sometimes.
Well, the AP is reporting that a high-ranking Iraqi defense minister says A huge plot was foiled, and the plot was to infiltrate the Green Zone where the American and coalition forces are protected in Baghdad, that several hundred al-Qaeda recruits were going to take it over and had already infiltrated the security system when this plot was foiled. Do you know any more about that?
I know that they arrested one person who told them about this plot and that some other defense ministry officials have been arrested since then. I don't have a feel myself for how serious it is. And the American officials I talked to did not know about it.
Well, Ellen Nickmeyer, again, covering the trial of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad. What is the sense of how the trial is going to proceed with Saddam seeming to just use the witness chair for a platform for, as you said, to speak to Iraqi people?
Well, this is scheduled to be his day of testimony, and after this, he may not have as many forums to speak up during the trial, and it could go pretty quickly to wrapping up the trial and going to judging of guilt and any sentencing.
When you say pretty quickly, you have a sense? Days, weeks?
Well, a few months ago, Americans were hoping that it was going to wrap up in May. It's possible it could go to the judgment phase, kind of along those timelines.
Ellen Nickmeyer of The Washington Post speaking to us from Baghdad. Ellen, thanks so much as always.
You're welcome.
Well, a TV and internet ad blitz to get out what it frames as the good news in Iraq is causing controversy in Minnesota. The conservative advocacy group Progress for America, which helped launch the Swift Boat ad campaign of the 2004 presidential elections, is sponsoring an effort to change how Midwesterners feel about the Iraq War.
I fought in Iraq with the 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing.
I was in Iraq for 18 months with the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment.
I was in Iraq for 12 months with the 3rd Corps Support Command.
The media only reports the bad news, but American troops are making real progress securing free elections and defending our country from radical al-Qaeda terrorists who want to destroy America, starting in Iraq.
Well, Iowa State Senator Chuck Larson is founder of Families United for Our Troops. Members of that group participate in the campaign, which is funded by Progress for America. Senator Larson served in Iraq for a year as a major in the Army Reserves. He joins us on the line. Senator, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And what was the concern that launched this campaign, that sparked this campaign?
Well, after I returned from Iraq in February of 2005, that following summer, I started Families United for Our Troops and their mission as a way to get the good news out about everything that our young men and women have accomplished in the war on terror. And we're a coalition of Gold Star families, those that have lost loved ones in the war, Blue Star families, those that have loved ones currently in the combat zone, and returning veterans.
And support for the troops is one thing, but why this ad campaign now?
Well, the ads actually help get our good news stories out. And although they were not funded by my organization, Progress for America saw the work that we were doing. They asked if any of our members would be interested in participating, and a tremendous number of Gold Stars wanted to participate, as well as returning veterans.
Well, Senator Larson, what do you think the disconnect is? Because I'm wondering if the recent polls were also on your mind. USA Today poll shows that a majority of Americans, 57%, think the war was a mistake. Another 60% think the war is either going moderately badly or very badly.
Well, I've been on the ground, and I've seen the successes firsthand. I would estimate that 95% of the Iraqis are freedom-loving people. They've lived under the sadistic reign of Saddam Hussein for 30 years. There are estimates that the mass graves have about 1 million people in them. So we're talking about a junior Hitler or a junior Stalin, and I don't think if we'd backed up and looked at World War II, we would have said, oh, we made a tremendous mistake in taking Hitler out after he'd slaughtered all of these people.
Well, Americans may not disagree that Saddam Hussein is a very bad man, but what they're saying is that the war isn't going very well.
It's actually going much better than what we see on the nightly news, unfortunately. There are 18 states in Iraq. 16 of those 18 are very, very peaceful. There are two problem areas, and that's part of Baghdad and parts of Ramadi. But you may remember about a year and a half ago, Mukhtar al-Sadr, the Shiite cleric, was holed up in a mosque. The city of Najaf was out of control. Well, now, a year and a half later, 100% of Najaf is under the control of the Iraqi army and the civilian police force. Not a single U.S. soldier is patrolling those streets. Not only Najaf, but the city of Karbala, Taji, Tikrit, and my understanding now, Fallujah as well, and four sectors in Baghdad. So that demonstrates that progress is being made, and as the Iraqi government stands up, their army and their civilian police force stands up, we will pass that baton over to them, and they'll manage their affairs.
You, on your Midwest Heroes website, point out that 774 schools have been built, 5.4 million Iraqis are subscribing to cell phone usage, number of U.S. troops wounded has gone down, and yet, again, Senator, analysts are saying the country's on the verge of a civil war. Reporters with boots on the ground and soldiers with boots on the ground are saying that they worry that civil war is imminent. So there seems to be a real disconnect.
There does, and I think the national media is dead intent on convincing Americans that we're on the verge of civil war.
Do you think it's just the media?
I talk to soldiers on a regular basis that talk about the successes. They're out patrolling the streets, and they're peaceful and they're quiet. So no, I don't think that's the case. I know the Iraqis, as I've said, and you have to remember there are two very, very bad elements in Iraq right now. One is al-Qaeda, who we've been fighting, and two, the former elements of Saddam Hussein's regime. They lost their power and control. They want it back. They're doing everything they can to drive a wedge in between the Sunnis and the Shias to start a civil war. And we have to be careful not to fuel that here in America.
Well, Senator, as you know, some are criticizing your campaign for conflating those two things you just mentioned, al-Qaeda and nationalists. Let's listen to one of your ads.
Those who know Iraq best are the soldiers who served there and the families of those who died there.
September 11th, 2001, the battle began in the streets of America. These people are out to destroy us.
If we were not fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq, I am convinced we'd be fighting them in America. And all we have to do is look back at September 11th.
And thank God there were people like Michael who would put their lives on the line for the rest of our country and our world.
Senator, the U.S., President Bush, did not go to Iraq to fight al-Qaeda. Do you think it's fair to bring September 11th into a discussion of Iraq when Saddam Hussein and Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11?
No, but Zarqawi is in Iraq right now. He's the one that's cutting heads off of individuals that have been captured. That is al-Qaeda, isn't it?
He is al-Qaeda in Iraq now.
Okay, I thought you were saying that al-Qaeda isn't in Iraq.
Most Americans understand we did not go to Iraq to fight al-Qaeda.
We were attacked on September 11th. This was not the first attack by al-Qaeda against our nation. There was a very strong indication that Iraq had aided terrorists in the past, and we know that they had weapons of mass destruction. He's gassed the Kurds, killed thousands of them. That's why the decision was made to remove Saddam Hussein.
Senator, what's your goal in this campaign?
Well, our goal, again, is to get the good news out about everything that our young men and women have accomplished in the war on terror. We've seen that more men and women have voted in free and fair elections in the last 12 months than in the last 6,000 years. And from a national security perspective, there's nothing more important than a stable, peaceful, democratic Middle East.
Do you think that Americans can support the troops, which many Americans say they do, and still be against the war?
The troops are the mission, and so I think it's very, very important to support the troops and their mission. I don't think it's possible to say we support you, but we don't believe in what you're doing. These young men and women are working 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, and what fuels them and keeps them going is knowing that our nation stands with them.
Iowa State Senator Chuck Larson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, just ahead, a Minnesota newspaper columnist responds. He says the Midwest Heroes campaign is a political campaign and one that manipulates Iraq vets. He also says Minnesota is just a test market. If the campaign helps shift public opinion in support of the war, watch for it to come to your state. Nick Coleman is up next. Much more coming up here and now. Response to the Midwest Heroes ad campaign, a blitz of television ads in Minnesota that just wrapped up, and an ongoing website with the message that American troops are making progress in Iraq. The campaign is paid for by the Republican advocacy group Progress for America, the same group that backed the anti-Kerry Swift vote campaign. Star Tribune columnist Nick Coleman has devoted three of his columns to pointing out discrepancies in the Midwest Heroes ad campaign. He joins us now from Minneapolis. And Nick, Senator Larson just said if one does not support the war, one does not support the troops, that the troops are the mission. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that's a very big warning sign that the war and public support for it are headed in different directions. We started out, I think everybody, no matter what their misgivings or doubts about the causes of the war, the wisdom of the war might have been, all felt like we had to show support for the troops. I think people who oppose the war still would claim that they support the troops and show respect for the sacrifices and the dedication that have been made. But we're now seeing a divergence in this ad campaign, which is very political and very partisan, is driving that divergence.
Well, one of your columns say, vets say it best, support for troops doesn't equal support for war.
Well, I think it's very clear in some of the polls that have been done is that there is certain confusion among the troops as to why they are in Iraq, and certainly it's unclear how they're going to get out of Iraq, but it becomes increasingly clear in the surveys I've seen that they want to get out of Iraq. I think some of the concerns that I have about this ad campaign, which, by the way, is, you know, completely partisan and mobbed up with Republican and White House interests. This Progress for America group is a classic AstroTurf campaign, appears to make this look like it's a grassroots campaign by, you know, combat veterans of Iraq telling us the truth, but that is not the truth. This campaign should be, you know, it should be labeled as a political and partisan campaign and not as just the voice of the common grunt coming back from Iraq. The vets, when they have criticized what I've written, have said, well, we just want to get our point across, our message across. But it's not their message. In fact, it's the White House message in another attempt, a side attempt, to bolster public support for a failing war policy.
Well, Nick, the vets and the parents of vets who have been killed who are in the campaign seem very sincere about, you know, wanting the troop and the war effort to be supported. What you're hearing also from other vets, what are you hearing?
You say that they quote in these ads parents of some of the fallen soldiers, and in fact, one of the ads explicitly says only, you know, that the families of the soldiers are the only ones who are really qualified to speak about Iraq, and yet they omit the mother of one of these soldiers featured in the ad campaign because she's a Gold Star mother, but she is a friend of Cindy Sheehan's, and she is a very outspoken critic of the war, Dolores Kesterson. She's not in the ad.
Well, what else concerns you about the content of the ads?
Well, they completely try to make this a war between the United States and al-Qaeda, the war on terror. That's not why we went there. There certainly are al-Qaeda fighters in Iraq now, but every estimate I've seen, and the most recent ones, would estimate less than 10% of the insurgents in Iraq are foreign fighters, and a small percentage of them would actually qualify as al-Qaeda fighters. So, you know, that is not the main problem in a country that's looking at civil war now
and as
may already be in the throes of civil war.
As you write in one of your columns, the CIA, the president has even said, no, there really was no connection between al-Qaeda and Iraq.
Well,
when we went to war.
And I think that these are the kind of, you know, you already see some people now on the pro-war side saying that, well, we couldn't win in Iraq fighting with one arm tied behind our back. It's almost an echo of the Vietnam thing. And this concerns me because I do think people on all sides in this era have tried very hard to be respectful of the troops, of the service of the troops, and to divorce, you know, support for them and their families from questions about the policies and questions about the politics of this war. And I think these ads are making it more difficult to do that.
Nick, how big was this ad campaign in Minnesota? What did it feel like?
Oh, it was hammering during the Olympics, the Winter Olympics, which, and this is a very popular market for watching the Winter Olympics. These ads were on every 10 minutes. In fact, I know many people who didn't want their children watching the Olympics because there are piles of bodies in some of these ads. They're very explicit and graphic. These are not the soldiers coming back from Iraq deciding we got to get our message out and raising money at the Legion Club. This ad campaign in Minnesota, my best guess is costing $1 million. And this is just a test market because they want to see if this can shore up public support, if this can stem the decline in support for the war, then you're going to see this kind of ad campaign around the rest of the country.
Well, and again, there were TV ads, posters in the mail, internet ads. What do you think the effect was?
Well, I think it's certainly,
Do you think
it wasn't a very good effect. I don't see any actual evidence that it's all of a sudden turning around public sentiment on the war, but it is increasing the temperature level and making it more difficult, more painful. I would say the letters to the editor, the criticisms I received, some of the name-calling that went back and forth has just made the whole climate much uglier, much more difficult to talk about what we do want to get out of Iraq and when we want to get out of Iraq.
Nick Coleman is a columnist for the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Nick, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
And remember, you can find links to both Nick's columns and the MidwestHeroes.com campaign at our website, here-now.org. Quick note about a story we're following. The body of Slobodan Milosevic has arrived in Belgrade. Milosevic, the former president of Serbia-Montenegro, died this weekend in The Hague in the Netherlands, where he was on trial for war crimes committed during the wars in the former Yugoslavia. He'll be buried in Serbia. And tomorrow we'll speak with a Bosnian Muslim who survived the slaughter at Srebrenica. He'll tell us what he thinks the future of the Balkans are now that Milosevic is gone. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR. New twist on the old midnight snack. Sleep specialists say a growing body of evidence suggests that the sleep aid medication Ambien may be linked to some strange side effects. People ransacking their kitchens, eating everything in sight while still asleep. They don't even remember it when they wake up. There are also reports about people driving while asleep after taking Ambien. Sofonia Aventis, the French company that makes Ambien, is the subject of a class action lawsuit, but defends the drug as safe when taken as prescribed. Where Dr. Mark Mahold is director of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorder Center in Minneapolis. He joins us now. Doctor, are you surprised by all of this?
We actually reported sleep-related eating in a good number of people before we even had a lot of popular sleeping medications on the market. So certainly this sort of behavior occurs spontaneously. Actually, about 2 to 5% of adults will have occasional sleepwalking, so this sort of thing is not all that unusual.
You mean that, and some of us are a little familiar with it, you get up at like 3 in the morning and the next thing you know you're standing in front of the refrigerator and you haven't taken a sleep aid.
Right. So, I mean, these sorts of behaviors can happen in people in the absence of sleeping medication. Now, things that will promote these behaviors are anything that causes sedation, and that would be alcohol or any sleeping medication. And now that, first of all, insomnia is very, very prevalent. 20 to 30% of adults have insomnia. Now we have some very effective sleeping medications. And so that's why we're seeing so many prescriptions written for Ambien, Sonata, and Zopiclone, which are the new, very effective sleeping medications. And these medications will, you know, promote these sorts of behaviors in people who are susceptible to having them, and so that we're seeing more now.
But it still sounds impossible. I mean, a woman in a body cast who can't even get out of bed without help when she's awake, then she takes Ambien, and sound asleep, she's suddenly standing at a stove frying bacon and eggs.
What's really interesting is that the explanation for all these behaviors, whether they're medication-related or not, is that sleep does not involve the whole brain at the same time, necessarily. So sleep is not a global or a whole brain phenomenon. We can have part of our brain that's awake and part that's asleep. And if the part that's awake is the motor system and the part that's asleep is the part that normally monitors what we're doing and keeps track of what we're doing in terms of memory, then we can perform very, very complicated behaviors without conscious awareness and without memory. And again, this is what sleepwalking is, and sleepwalking occurs in 2 to 5% of normal adults, so it's very, very common.
And it reminds us of the case in Canada in 1987 where a man claimed that he was sleepwalking when he got in a car, drove several miles to his in-laws, killed them,
and then told police that he was sleepwalking. And at that time, they said that there was an issue called automatism. Is that what you've been speaking of?
What this is, very simplistically, is a mixed state of being. The brain is literally half awake and half asleep, awake enough to perform very complex behaviors, but not awake enough to be aware of what they're doing or responsible for what they're doing. And certainly sleeping medications can promote this in people who are susceptible to it. Now, many of the people who have had these behaviors have actually been taking much more than the recommended maximum dosage of the sleeping medications, or they've been mixing with alcohol and just kind of increasing their chance of having these behaviors. So it's not known whether this is more apt to be seen with Ambien than the other sleeping medications, or an equally good explanation would be that Ambien is by far and away the most widely prescribed sleeping medication, and that may be why we're seeing it more with Ambien than the others, just because of the sheer numbers of people who are receiving it.
We know 26 million people got Ambien prescriptions last year. 26 million. Now, you said sleeping disorders are, you know, an increasing problem, but are there really that many people, or has this company, you know, as you said, just done a good job advertising Ambien and people think they need it?
Well, I think they've done a good job of advertising, but I think, you know, again, for perspective, insomnia is very, very common. It's 20-30% of adults will have insomnia often enough so that they say it's a problem for them.
And by the way, when you say insomnia, I mean, you know, we all have trouble sleeping every now and then. What is real insomnia?
What we're talking about in these 20-30% are people who have insomnia often enough so that they feel it's a problem for them. And actually, if you look at the consequences of insomnia, insomnia is second only to child-rearing issues as an explanation for people missing work. Yeah, I think the field of sleep medicine has been, you know, glad to see some of these newer, generally very, very safe medications. And I think that the important thing is that all medications that physicians prescribe have side effects. There's no question about that. There's no free lunch in any medication. And I think that if people who have insomnia who are receiving the medication are told up front that one of the potential side effects, albeit very uncommon, is complicated behavior arising from the sleep period, I think that that would be fine. I don't think that we should stop prescribing these medications because there are a small, you know, a small percentage of people who have the side effects. That having been said, there are some groups of people that should not take sleeping medications under any circumstances, and those two groups are, number one, people who are on call at night and may be responsible for having to make important decisions upon being wakened by a phone call in the middle of the sleep period.
Yeah.
The second group, and this is one that a lot of people don't think about, is a parent who is a single parent responsible for the care of a very small child. Because if somebody is awakened in the middle of the night after having taken any sleeping medication, the person will be impaired. There's no question about it, because that's what these drugs do.
And I'm thinking that those poor single parents are the ones who may, you know, need help on occasion sleeping, but you're saying...
It may be. We certainly see a lot of people like that. We tell them very clearly that, unfortunately, because of the responsibilities that they have in the middle of the night, they are not candidates for sleeping medications. And then we can use some of the often very effective behavioral treatments for insomnia. And most people who have insomnia, at least in the hands of sleep medicine professionals, have their insomnia treated with a combination of behavioral and pharmacologic or prescription treatment, with the idea that once the insomnia is improved with this combination of treatment, the medication can often be tapered and discontinued.
Dr. Mark Mahawal, director of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorders Center, speaking to us from Minneapolis about strange behavior associated somewhat with the sleep aid drug Ambien. Reports of people sleep eating after taking the drug. One woman even gained 100 pounds. Now, the company that makes the drug, Sanofi Aventis, says this is a rare side effect. And as you heard from Dr. Mahawald, and we want to make sure we're clear on this, this drug is still one that doctors such as yourself welcome with caution.
Oh, absolutely. Just like with any medication and all of medicine, it has side effects. And as long as the prescribing physician knows it and the patient knows it, I think that there's no reason not to prescribe it. Now, the woman that gained 100 pounds, was not told ahead of time that the medication may be associated with sleep eating. Now, had she been forewarned that sleep eating may be a consequence, she probably would have stopped after she gained 5 or 10 pounds rather than waiting until she gained 100.
Or put a lock on the fridge or something.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Doctor, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your interest.
And still to come, Director Robert Town, you're listening to Here and Now. A new report on assisted suicide shows that there was little increase in the number of terminally ill patients in Oregon who asked their doctors for assisted suicide in the time since the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a landmark Oregon law allowing it last January. 38 people ended their lives under the law in 2005, just one person more than the year before. In their ruling, the Supreme Court said that the Bush administration improperly threatened to use a federal drug law against the Oregon doctors who prescribe lethal doses of medicine to dying patients who request it, saying the states have the right to regulate medical treatment for the terminally ill. Well, Lonnie Shavelson is a doctor, a journalist, and an author of A Chosen Death, The Dying Confront Assisted Suicide. He sent us this story on his own confrontation with his father's death in Florida.
My father was a soft-spoken man who moved to Florida at 75 after a lifetime in New York's Garment District. And because he had his first of 3 heart attacks when he was 65, my dad spent years thinking about death. After my mother died, he'd be awakened to the early morning hours playing Guy Lombardo records while talking to me and my sister through a tape recorder. We found that tape after he died.
Abide with me, the darkness deepens. I guess you're laughing at my singing. Some of the roughest times I've had, I've been able to find something funny, and that's what life is more than anything else to me.
Though my dad sang and laughed to my sister and me on the tape, he relived the more difficult memories as well.
Remember, Lon, a number of years back, when I was in a hospital, I had my bypass done, and you came in from California. Operation is over. As I opened my eyes, first one I saw was you, and you were consoling me, okay, Dad. Everything's fine. And I recall how I felt when I was in a hospital. The worst thing that could happen to me was everybody is in control of me, that I couldn't control any of my own life at all.
Later that year, my dad lapsed into unconsciousness from a sudden cardiac pause. His brain died. His body did not. I rushed to the hospital, and he was deep in a coma, kept alive by a breathing machine. We had discussed how he might die, and under what circumstances he would not want to live.
Dying is dying. You gotta die sometime.
Red sails in the sunset, way out on the sea. All carry my loved one home safely to me.
I showed the doctors his living will that specifically expressed his wishes not to be kept alive by machinery. Now, we stood by my father's unconscious body and turned off the machines. But what was left of my dad's brain took over, just enough to keep him barely breathing. The rush of adrenaline from glands that still argued for life drenched him in sweat. For hours he lay gasping for breath, but not dying. Please, I asked his doctor, can we give him more sedation, stop the agony of this prolonged suffocation? We can't do that, she replied. It's illegal. Although we had intended for my father to die, his continued breathing now had changed the rules. There's a fine legal distinction between withdrawing life support and administering medications that might slow or stop his breathing, which is forbidden by law. I wiped at my father's soaking forehead. For hours, I whispered loving words to ease this agonizing end. And then I could abandon him no longer. Excuse me, I said to the nurse. I need to be alone with my dad. Behind the closed doors, I held my father in my arms and faced my own decision. Moments later, the shrill alarms of the ICU monitors announced that my father's breathing and heartbeat had stopped. I cradled my dad, the two of us alone, finally, in peace. After the recent Supreme Court decision clearing the way for assisted suicide in Oregon, debates about aid in dying are again at a heated pitch, and more legal battles are to come. And yet, perhaps one quiet voice can break through this din of debate.
All right, until next time. Thanks for listening.
From San Francisco, this has been Lonnie Shavelson and his father.
And his father's favorite music. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Town, one of the most revered films of the 70s, now considered a classic. In it, screenwriter Robert Towne painstakingly recreated Los Angeles in the 30s. Now he's returned to that era with his adaptation of John Fante's cult novel Ask the Dust. It took Towne 35 years to get this movie made. Producer Andrea Shea spoke with a Hollywood legend about his obsession with Ask the Dust and with L.A.
Chinatown is a portrait of Los Angeles coming of age as a city of dreams during the Great Depression. It's Hollywood noir at its finest, where glamour and glitz mask corruption and depravity.
Okay, go home. But in case you're interested, your husband was murdered. Somebody has been dumping thousands of tons of water from the city's reservoirs, and we're supposed to be in the middle of a drought. He found out about it, and he was killed. There's a waterlogged drunk in the morgue, involuntary manslaughter if anybody wants to take the trouble, which they don't. It seems like half the city is trying to cover it all up, which is fine by me. But Mrs. Mulray, I goddamn near lost my nose, and I like it. I like breathing through it. And I still think that you're hiding something.
Robert Towne was an unknown when he started writing Chinatown in the early 1970s. While researching 1930s L.A., he came across Ask the Dust, an obscure autobiographical novel written by John Fante, a largely forgotten author.
I was shocked. You know, this is one of those proverbial desert flowers that had bloomed with no one there to see it.
First published in 1939, Towne says Ask the Dust took him back to the L.A. he wanted to recreate in Chinatown. The book describes a bustling, arid city on the edge of the desert. Towne, an L.A. native, says it also took him back to the parched city of his youth.
I had forgotten that there was this blazing sun that would come off of buildings without much foliage between you and the sun or the building, so it made light much brighter. And there wasn't foliage to hold the dust off the ground. There was literally dust in the air. I remember that. And I also felt how much I had missed my own memories of my childhood, more specifically the city itself. And in a way, it pointed the way to me for what I was subsequently to do, which was to write Chinatown and make a character out of the city.
Jake, what are you doing here?
Nothing, Morty. It's my lunch hour. Thought I'd drop by and see who dropped dead lately.
Yeah? Isn't this something? Middle of a drought and the water commissioner drowns. Only in L.A.
Yeah.
And while Chinatown is about politics and murder, Ask the Dust is about L.A.'s allure. Towne calls it a city of illusions, populated by transients dreaming of health, wealth, fame, and a new beginning.
What is more L.A. than the dream factory of Hollywood, where people come to have those dreams come true. In the case of Dust, it's a story about a writer who comes to L.A. to write the great American novel and make his dreams come true. And in the course of it, writes about a city and a place where everybody's come to make their dreams come true.
See, Teresa, please inspire me. Just let me meet one of those beautiful golden-haired girls and I'll write a love story, one of the greatest of all time.
That's actor Colin Farrell playing writer Arturo Bandini in Ask the Dust. Bandini is the picture of angry, determined youth and is author John Fonte's alter ego. Fonte was born in Colorado and moved to L.A. to become a writer when he was 20 years old. Like his character, Fonte struggled to create and survive in a rundown hotel in L.A. Towne says, as a writer, he connected with the character's desperation.
He's self-absorbed. He's narcissistic. He's insecure. He's manic depressive. he's thin-skinned and defensive about his work. You know, I can identify with that, you know? I mean, everybody who writes can identify. He's insecure because he spends an unusually large percentage of his time alone in a room, wondering about if he really is a writer. I mean, who says I'm a writer? I'm not published. Nobody knows about me. Am I just a crazy person sitting in a room?
Town says his empathy for that character and his passion for the book drove him to find Fonte. He wanted to talk to the author about making the novel into a film. In 1971, Town visited Fonte's home, where he says the 70-year-old author was reclusive and hostile.
He was very much like the character in the book, and not at all pleased to see me. I mean, who the hell are you? And what makes you think you can adapt my book into a movie? What makes you think anybody will let you? For that matter, what makes me think you can write? What have you written? What have you done? Of course, I didn't have an answer for that. But I really think your book is wonderful. What does it matter what you think? I mean, who says your judgment is worth anything? That was our first meeting, which was contentious, but it also made me laugh.
In the end, Fonte gave Town permission to adapt his novel for the screen, and Town became a champion of Fonte's work. At the time, Town had a few finished scripts under his belt for Chinatown, Shampoo, and The Last Detail, but the studios weren't interested in making them into movies. He says he was convinced his films would never come to life.
And I was going to be as unknown as John Fanny on his most anonymous day. So I suppose there's a sense in which my rescue fantasy of rescuing this book from obscurity was a way of rescuing both of us.
As it turns out, Town didn't need Ask the Dust to find salvation. He sold his scripts and in 1974 won the Best Screenplay Oscar for Chinatown, launching a very busy career in Hollywood. Fonte also wrote for the screen as a younger man, but unlike Town's now classic movies, Fonte's faded away. His books, though, are remembered thanks in part to street poet and barfly Charles Bukowski. Like Town, Bukowski stumbled upon Ask the Dust while rummaging the stacks at the library. He called Fonte a god and claimed the heart and guts in the writing changed his life. In 1980, Bukowski convinced his publisher to reprint Ask the Dust. A cult was born as a new generation of writers embraced Fonte's unique voice. But Town says Fonte was only able to enjoy the adoration for a few years.
And then his diabetes caught up with him, and he died. And that was upsetting to me, to put it mildly. And years went by. And then finally in 1993, I sat down and wrote the screenplay.
Town says it took over a decade to cobble together the financing for Ask the Dust. He and the lead actors, Selma Hayek and Colin Farrell, even sacrificed their salaries to make the movie a reality.
You think you're so smart? You're going to write a book and have the world on a string. Huh? Well, what if you don't?
I will.
Yeah, but what if you don't?
I will.
You're book smart, but you're not smart. And you're not rich. And you're not nice. You're loud, angry, and poor.
Town laments the fact that John Fonte never had the chance to see his much-loved novel on the big screen. I asked if he thought the author would be pleased.
Knowing John, I'm sure he would have something bad to say about it, because he couldn't help himself. And then I think he'd say, yeah, well, you did a pretty good job.
Robert Towne says Ask the Dust is the great L.A. novel. Without it, perhaps Chinatown, considered by many to be the great L.A. film, might never have been made.
Andrea Shea speaking with writer and director Robert Towne. Ask the Dust opens in theaters nationwide next week. And by the way, this music from the Chinatown soundtrack was composed by one of our favorites, Jerry Goldsmith. Speaking of favorites, today we're bidding adieu to our intern, Jessica Gerard, who, having tasted journalism, is now thinking of taking up medicine. Jessica, thanks for all your help and time. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.